Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in it. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the S section of the Monster Manual. It's pretty long. And we've got four great monsters, including one that I already did a full-length episode on, so we're not going to cover it in any real detail. Before we do that, though, it's time to take care of some business. First off, let's thank a new Patreon supporter. This is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like today's patron, you pledge at the $2 level or higher, you'll also get access to my new podcast, Patron Deities, where I do for the Deities and Demigods book what I'm doing here for the Monster Man, but more kind of in-depth. So thank you very much to Robert Oberlies, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Thanks again. Second, it's time to remind you that there is an ongoing Monster Man contest. What's that, you say? Like the fabled first Monster Man contest, where competitors made monsters out of cheap toys and won wonderful prizes? Well, sort of. There's certainly monster making, and there's certainly wonderful prizes. But this time, the source is going to be a post on AIweirdness.com about names for Dungeons & Dragons monsters. And if you want to know the rules of the contest, you can either go to my blog, gonzohistorygaming.blogspot.co.uk, there'll be a link in the show notes, or you can just go back and listen to the episode before last, which was a special episode about neural network monsters. The deadline for entries is the end of April 14th, so get to work. All right, let's take a look at some monsters. We start with the slug, giant. Slugs are definitely one of the animals that gets scarier and, more importantly, grosser by getting large. We don't like slugs, at least I don't like slugs. And I think it's a boundaries thing. We don't like animals that are too flexible. There's something eerie about them. And they just slugs just look gross. I don't know if there's a psychological term for this or a scientific reason, but they just look revolting and I don't like them. And the slug, giant makes this even more obvious by having acid spit, which is particularly hideous, and a fun little mechanic where it always, or almost always, misses with the first shot. It has only a 1 in 10 chance to hit the first time it gobs acidic slime at you, but then after that, it's found your range. And I think that's kind of cool. I like the idea of a ranging shot, because the acid spittle is pretty bad news, and so the first shot kind of almost acts like a warning shot, which is a neat way to start out the encounter, right? You're suddenly going, whoa, what was that? Speaking of giant slugs, I never really get the chance to go to Free RPG Day event, which is a shame, although most publishers then make it available online. One of the publishers that really does a lot for Free RPG Day is Lamentations of the Flame Princess, and they used to, and maybe they still do, have a deal where you could get Free RPG Day stuff, the printed versions, either discounted or free, when you bought stuff from them at conventions, and that's how I got a hold of their Free RPG Day product from a couple years ago, which is called Slugs. And that's spelled slugs with an umlaut, and I gather that the umlaut is actually pronounced giant, so it should just say giant slugs, but I like to think of it as Slugs. It is by James, is it Raggi or Raggy? Anyway, the guy who did Lamentations of the Flame Princess and Kelvin Green. Cover art by Rich Longmore. And an illustration on the inside front cover, which shows a lady bashing a slug with a mace, and that's by Yannick Bouchard, and it's relevant to this show because it is an homage to the Jim Rosloff illustration from the Deities and Demigods book of Thor bashing the Midgard serpent with his hammer, and it's pretty spectacular. Anyway, this contains a bunch of different giant slug monsters. Well, I was starting to count them, but I don't have time for this. Anyway, it's a good number of giant slug monsters, and I've used one of them, the ocular slug, a hideous giant slug that switches the visual perspectives of creatures it touches in my game, and so this is a fun little product about giant slugs. Probably made me think more about slugs, or if you prefer slugs, than I otherwise would have. Anyway, slug, giant, super duper gross. Whether, you know, you've been shrunk down and are just trying to adventure through someone's garden, or whether you just happen to be in an environment where there are giant slugs everywhere, crawling around over surfaces, oozing gradually over things, gobbing digestive acid at people, everything about them is horrible. Oh, and they take no damage from blunt weapons because they're all gooshy. Oh, I hate just thinking about them. Next up, we have the snake, giant. Now look, I've said before that I sometimes feel like I don't have anything to say about classic monsters. And a classic monster, I mean, that's anything from Tolkien to some extent, and also it's anything that Conan might fight. Or indeed, in this instance, that Conan actually fought. In fact, I think Conan basically fought people, snakes, and apes. That was pretty much his deal. There are a lot of snakes in Conan stories, and for good reason. We're all kind of frightened of snakes, whether that's lots of people are kind of frightened of snakes. I certainly was terrified of snakes as a child. I live in a part of the I lived in a part of the world that has very few dangerous snakes. In fact, very few snakes of any kind. So I don't know why snakes bothered me so much. I was scared of a lot of the traditional animals you're scared of when you're a kid. I don't like spiders either. Now I don't really mind them. Anyway, Snakes, Comet, Giant. I mean, it's a Conan classic. It's a pulp adventure monster. There's a constricting one and a poisonous one and a sea one. So the snake that I'm going to focus on in this episode is the Amphisbaena, or Amphisbaena. And that is a snake with a head at each end, which moves by coiling itself up into a hoop with its two heads biting each other and then rolling along. Now, the Amphisbaena, or Amphisbaena, anyway, I'm going to say Amphisbaena. The Amphisbaena appears in various bits of classical literature, so there's references to it as some kind of monster. But I think that the earliest description of it comes from Aelian, the Greek naturalist who wrote a book called On Animals. And he says, quote, "The Amphisbaena is a snake with two heads, one at the top and one in the direction of the tail. When it advances, as need for a forward movement impels it, it leaves one end behind to serve as tail, while the other it uses as a head. Then again, if it wants to move backwards, it uses the two heads in exactly the opposite manner from what it did before." And in another part, he says, "Nicandros asserts that the slough, that is the shed skin, of the Amphisbaena, if wrapped around a walking stick, drives away all snakes and other creatures which kill not by biting but by striking." This seems to have been a pretty widespread belief, not just about the Amphisbaena, but that the shed skins of snakes had some kind of magical properties. And there are lots of different sources that discuss what the Amphisbaena's shed skin can do for you, or what eating its meat can do. And similarly, Pliny the Elder writes, "The Amphisbaena has a twin head, that is, one at its tail end as well, as though it were not enough for poison to be poured out of one mouth." And the first description of the hoop comes from Nonnus's Dionysiaca, from the 5th century AD, and he's talking about a necklace in the form of a snake. And he says, "It was like a serpent with star-spangled back and coiling shape, for as the two-headed Amphisbaena in very sooth winds the coils between and spits her poison from either mouth, rolling along and along with double gliding motion, and head crawling joins with head while she jumps twirling waves of her back sideways, so that magnificent necklace twisted, shaking its crooked back, blah, 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 blah." So I'm not sure if that's suggesting that it, he says that it rolls along, but I don't know if that means literally. In the Middle Ages, the Amphisbaena appears with legs, and is much more of a kind of, sometimes even wings, so much more of a kind of cockatrice-like creature, and I wonder if that comes from Diodorus Siculus, who talks about a similar creature that is more like a tortoise that actually has legs. Anyway, Amphisbaena, pretty great. And giant snakes, pretty great. Everything in your campaign is improved by the addition of a giant snake. Then we've got the Spectre. Now, the Spectre is a little bit like a ghost, but angrier, or not angrier, but more resentful. Now, if you go all the way back to the My Favorite Monster special, in which I interviewed digital game creator Hannah Powell Smith, we talked about ghosts, and we very briefly mentioned Spectres, and specifically the idea that life makes the Spectre lament the fact that it is dead, and so it tries to steal life from its targets. It doesn't get the life by doing so, but it tries to steal life from its target. And so the Spectre is pretty much just a fighty ghost with a chill touch. And if you go back and look at the ghost, it's interesting. Of course, ghost and spectre are really just kind of the same thing folklorically, but they emphasize different aspects of what that means. So the ghost is all about etherealness. It can only be harmed by people who are on the ethereal plane, for example. The ghost is all about insubstantiality, whereas the spectre is about death and deathiness and the fact that death hates life, which, personally, I would have gone the other way around, since spectre means, comes, I think, from a root word that means vision, right? Same root word as spectacle. So I would have maybe played it the other way, but whatever, you know. I'm sure someone had a thesaurus, right? I'm amazed that there isn't a, you know, apparition and a spook and a haint and so on. Anyway, I'm sure as we get into the other books, there will be. Anyway, the specter can be destroyed by casting Raise Dead on it, which you can go back and that's mentioned in the Mummy section. But what's interesting is that if you cast Raise Dead on the Mummy, it just comes back to life as a person. In fact, a high-level fighter who's probably still pretty mad at you. Well, I don't know. Maybe he'd be grateful. I don't know. But if you cast Raise Dead on the Spectre, it just vanishes. It doesn't return to life. Presumably because it just no longer has a body, but also maybe because we're starting to get this idea of the way that clerics are channeling energy from positive planes. And so, since undead are connected to the negative planes, it basically everything works backward. So casting a spell that would restore life to a living being destroys an undead being. Kind of makes sense. You got that in 3rd edition, I think, where you could heal damage to undead creatures by casting harm spells on them. Not harm, cause wounds, right? So instead of casting cure wounds to heal them, you would cast inflict wounds and vice versa. And finally, we have the Sphinx. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail about the Sphinx and its four different categories, the Androsphinx, Gynosphinx, Creosphinx, and Hierosphinx, and that's because I talked about them all in a special episode requested by Patreon backers Stan and Katie. So if you want to learn about the Sphinx, all you have to do is just scroll back through the feed of this podcast and find the special about the Sphinx. And I go into detail about the myths that it appears in, what the different types of it are, what the significance of all the different heads is, and so on. So yeah, in short, Sphinxes are interesting. You can use them in campaigns effectively, but I think they work a lot better if you kind of think about where they're going to fit in, rather than just kind of having them, you know, crouching around asking people riddles. There's some monsters that are very good to just kind of drop in at random. You know, most of the dungeon hazard monsters are a bit like that. And there's always sort of human-motivated type monsters or other intelligent monsters like orcs or whatever. I mean, intelligent, you know, relatively. I don't mean they're smart, but they can think. Those guys are always good to just kind of have around. They have their own agendas and they pursue them. But something as absolutely magical and mythological as the Sphinx sometimes requires a little more context. Anyway, if I've been kind of late-night radio voicing this one, I apologize. I'm still getting over that cold, so my voice is still a little bit hoarse. I do a lot of talking in my work, and I'm only just now kind of starting to get to relax it. But I hope that you've enjoyed this episode and that you will join me next time as we continue through the S section, and we talk about the spider, the sprite, the squid, giant, and the stag. That'll be next time on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the Deities and Demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.